This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross returns next time. I'm Sedj Thompson. My guests today are the co-authors of Jackson Pollock, An American Saga, Stephen Nafe and Gregory White-Smith. The biography tells a story of the cultural history of the United States from the last century to the mid-1950s. The biographers use the elaborate history as the setting for Jackson Pollock's own life. The authors are graduates of the Harvard Law School and eventually gave up the practice of law to write. This current collaboration took Nafe and Smith 8 years to research and write, including 2,000 interviews with 850 people who knew Pollock and his friends. The authors kept an elaborate card system to cross-reference different versions of the same stories, and over 100 pages of the book are devoted to identifying the sources of the anecdotes they use. They said it's as carefully prepared as a legal brief. In the course of their research, Pollock's widow, Lee Krasner, granted several interviews, as did members of the artist's family. The biography has engendered some controversy based on the author's conclusion about the artist's life, but Smith and Nafe say they needed to establish the setting for their conclusion about Pollock by building up the historical detail and lives of people around Pollock. In addition to a profile of Lee Krasner and her paintings, the book has substantial sections devoted to major figures in his life, including the painter Thomas Hart Benton, whose work as originalist and teacher influenced both Pollock and the art world. It seemed there must have been a point when the authors realized their biography would have to expand beyond the details of Pollock's life to include the background of Benton and the psychological aspects of other artists. I asked Nafe and Smith how different their completed biography is from that they first envisioned.
We began with a much more limited idea of what we were trying to do. And as we researched and got deeper and deeper, our ambitions for the project grew.
Proportionally. It became apparent to us that one of the sort of central themes of our book was the place of art in American society and how this affected the artist, and in particular, that in the 19th century America, art was seen as a women's activity. It was something that a farm wife would involve herself in, either in terms of taking little painting classes or reading poetry or having little clubs that they would come to and give talks on artists. In Tingley, Iowa, where his mother was born, it's really quite wonderful to think that these farm women would gather and give talks on Rosa Bonheur or Raphael. Meanwhile, of course, their husbands had nothing to do with this and thought it was essentially a women's activity. Well, for the sons of these people, becoming artists was necessarily a potential problem, especially if their egos were at all insecure, and as were Pollock's own ego and Thomas Hart Benton's. So we tell the story partly to show that the problems Jackson faced in becoming an artist in a world in which art was considered a sissy activity were the same problems that other artists faced, but reacted to them differently. In Benton's case, he tried to compensate for this, especially after his father's death. And at the time of his father's death, he turned strictly from abstract art to a kind of to the better known regionalist style, and in particular to a kind of populist subject matter that was his effort to make that art acceptable to his father. And this is not just our psychoanalytic explanation. He really discusses that switch fairly articulately himself in his many writings and autobiographical writings.
I think you also go into chapters also on Krishnamurti and on some of the Jungian ideas that attracted Pollock.
Well, one of the things that came through very clearly was that Jackson had a very different kind of intelligence. We've been criticized for suggesting that Jackson was not an intelligent person, somehow demeaning him. In fact, we do not say that at all. What we say, to paraphrase one of his own analysts, is that Jackson had an intelligence that was very different from most of the people who are listening to this show. He was not a verbal person. He did not understand things on a verbal level. He understood them on an intuitive level. On that intuitive level, he was extremely intelligent, extremely acute, but he didn't really understand them in the ways that many of us might understand them. And we felt it was important to convey that.
I was interested in your account of how Pollock began his drip paintings to bring in sort of the idea of the hallucinations that he may have had inspired by migraines.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's brand new information. That's never been known before. It wasn't that he had the migraines and then painted them. The source on this is very clear that Jackson, after he began to paint the drip paintings, realized that he had seen the image before in his I guess they're called optical hallucinations that he had had periodically throughout his life.
But he had what are all clinically known as ocular migraines. These take different forms, but in Jackson's case, it was like small specks would whirl around in his field of vision. And he thought he was going crazy or else that he was going blind. And Roger, who had done a lot of work in the area of optical science, was able to reassure him that, in fact, he wasn't going crazy and that he wasn't going blind, that this was a... these were the results of certain kinds of migraines, not the kind of migraine that gives you a headache, but the kind of migraine that gives you one of these optical patterns. And Jackson himself commented on how these images resembled the swirling patterns in many of his drip paintings. The other thing that we learned, which was probably even more significant, and we think this is critical to understanding those images, is that when Jackson was dripping paint, he was not creating a two-dimensional image. He was not creating a two-dimensional abstract image, even though the Greenbergians have tried to suggest that over the years. In fact, as several of his closest friend painters described to us, he was painting in the air. He was wrapping three-dimensional images in lariats of paint, which then would, because of gravity, fall to the ground and form two-dimensional abstract images, so that even in his most abstract paintings, there is a subject matter that was contained in the air at the time he painted the painting, which later lost its recognizability. This was extremely important in understanding why his dripped paintings have the level of energy and passion that they have. They weren't simply decorative exercises. They were Jackson Pollock painting images, and like all of the images in his career, essentially demonic hallucinations from his daytime nightmares.
My guests are the authors of the new biography, Jackson Pollock, An American Saga, Stephen Nafe and Gregory White Smith. You know, his paintings have always sort of sprung out in a way with color and texture, and your description of how he painted makes it seem like I should see them springing out even more, like right out into the air, that seeing them as sort of drip as if going down a wall is the wrong way to view them.
No, that they were definitely they were painted in the air, and they have that that wonderful sense of liberation. In fact, I think one of the great benefits to us of writing this book was getting to know those paintings and getting to know them so well. And I must say, over 8 years, our respect and amazement at his achievement only increased. The quality of those paintings is really just quite staggering, especially, and this is another controversial aspect of the book, especially in view of his seeming technical lack of proficiency. I mean, when he first started painting, he had no ability to reproduce reality with any kind of academic skill. He far from seeming like a potential genius, his classmates in various art schools wondered if he could ever become an artist at all.
One of his great fears was whether or not he could draw, wasn't it?
Exactly, and he couldn't in the conventional sense. Of course, what he did is he created his own kind of draftsmanship, which he had an enormous control over, and those paintings have a non-academic draftsmanship, which is thrilling, but in terms of being able to take a typewriter, to use his own example, and reproduce it, that he just couldn't do that. And one of the miracles of his life is that he really sort of changed the rules. Instead of learning how to draw a typewriter, he changed the rules so that you didn't know how to draw a typewriter.
One of the challenges of doing a biography of Jackson Pollock is, other than his paintings and stories about him, he left a very small written record. What, like three letters you came across?
Well, it was very few, and only a few notes. Not only did he leave a very limited written record, because he was so nonverbal, he relatively rarely discussed his work with other people. In fact, in the past, I think we were really the first people, researchers to have gone out and tried to find those few friends to, with whom Jackson felt comfortable talking about his art. And I think the book benefits enormously from the from Jackson's own thoughts about his work and about his life. But it's true, it would have been far more desirable to have a huge stock of letters and diaries and journals and things. Instead, what we had to do frequently was to try to piece together his life, not from letters, but from the memories of people around him. And I think that explains why we went out and interviewed more than 800 people. It was because we really had to, the slate was blank, and if we hadn't undertaken this massive research effort, I think the life would have passed us all by, because many of these people we were interviewing were getting quite old. Many of the most important interviewees have died. Lee Krasner herself, two of his oldest brothers, any number of close friends. We were lucky enough to begin our work just at the last point when a thorough account could have been obtained.
You depict Jackson Pollock as a troubled man, confused about his sexuality, and from an early age given to great alcoholic binges. What was the role of alcohol in his life?
Well, he was an alcoholic, a severe one. In fact, all five brothers were at one stage or another alcoholics. In fact, he was committed for alcoholic psychosis to the Bloomingdale's, the institution in White Plains, and he was repeatedly taken to Bellevue in the middle of drunken binges. He rarely, however, ever painted when drunk, and in fact, alcohol, far from liberating him, really prevented him from painting much of the time. And many of his greatest paintings were done during the 2 years in Long Island when, under his wife Lee Krasner's care, he was able to more or less stop drinking for 2 years. And in the last 4 years of his life, he painted almost nothing because he was in a drunken state virtually all of the time. In terms of his sexual confusion, Jackson was something of a macho symbol to a whole generation of artists, and it has come as something of a shock to realize that he was subject to a certain amount of confusion. In fact, as a child, we heard stories about him demanding to play the mommy rather than the daddy and making little girls in the neighborhood play the daddy. Later in life, there were incidents, drunken incidents, in the homosexual subculture of New York, and his relations with women were extremely troubled. In almost every case of there were really only two other sexual liaisons other than Lee's, both of them extremely brief, and in both cases prompted by the woman. We go into this in considerable depth, not for any sensationalist effect, although some people might think so. The fact is, this was a man for whom sexuality was the subject matter of many of his paintings. He was, after all, a man who painted works like Male and Female, the great work at the Philadelphia Art Museum, which is a painting of a man with breasts and a woman with a penis. It seemed to us irresponsible not to try to understand why he was painting these paintings of confused sexuality. By the same token, so many of his paintings are portraits of his mother, whom he depicted as this outrageous monster, this bloated, naked woman with her legs wide open, wearing nothing but earrings and high-heeled shoes. And it seemed to us absolutely essential for a biographer to try to understand what in his relationship with this seemingly pleasant and conscientious housewife from the farms of Iowa would have prompted him to depict her as this ghoulish monster. And much of the book is an attempt to come to terms with those aspects of his life that made their way into his paintings.
You constantly make the point that he needed to rebel, and part of perhaps some of the outrageous stunts, the urinating at people in Peggy Guggenheim's fireplace, the fights that he would get into were to both call attention to himself as well as alienate people from him.
Right.
How was this taken in the New York art community at the time? Was he indulged in because he was an artist, or did this put people off?
You hit it. Ironically, the more famous he became, the more the limits melted, and the more the limits melted, the more he needed to do to get the kind of attention he wanted. So it really was kind of a vicious circle. As he garnered some, we'll call it fame, although we should keep in mind that it wasn't really fame in the modern sense. There are a lot of people who, it was more like infamy in some people's minds. As he became well-known, people became much more tolerant about his behavior. There was very much a feeling that, oh, this was just, this was artistic genius, and it should be given a wide berth because that's just the way we treat it. You know, the 50s was a very sort of bohemian decade anyway in that circle, and there was a lot of outrageous behavior in a lot of ways, Jackson was just sort of part of that, and so I think he was given much more leeway than he would have been. And, of course, ironically, the more leeway he was given, the more he had to do to get the kind of attention that he so craved. And one could even argue that, to some extent, when he killed himself, when he drove off the road in East Hampton, going 90 miles an hour in the middle of the night down a road, that he was yet again looking for some sort of attention. Now, I don't think it was a conscious attempt to commit suicide. I don't think he would have consciously imperiled someone else. Someone else was killed in the car wreck, but I think it was psychologically indistinguishable from suicide.
Was there a turning point in Pollock's life where he was going from being a struggling artist, trying to paint and draw and get it right, to suddenly he saw a new way to approach the world through his art? What turned him as an artist?
I would say it's a great question. I think there are probably, as in any artist's life, there were a series of points. You could isolate maybe two or three that were key moments in his life. One was when he was a teenager out in Los Angeles, and he had been expelled from school for the third time in 3 years, and he was clearly never going to finish high school. He didn't know what he wanted to do. His art was unrecognized. It was hardly even art at that point. I mean, he was still doing a little bit of clay sculpture and that sort of thing. And he really didn't know where he was going to go. And he got a letter from his older brother, Charles, who was in New York studying with Thomas Hart Benton. And I think that letter was a key turning point in his life. I think meeting Lee Krasner in the early 40s was a key turning point in his life.
What did the letter say about Thomas Hart Benton?
Well, it basically said, Jackson, get your life together. You are worthwhile. You do have something to contribute. Have you thought about being an architect, actually, is the way Charles put it. It wasn't so much exactly what he said as the fact that he said anything, because Jackson had grown up basically ignored by his oldest brother and adoring his oldest brother. And so to get any sort of communication from Charles, I think, was enormously helpful at a very, very needful time in his life. We talk about in the book how he met John Graham in the late 30s. John Graham was a wonderful, enigmatic character in American art, very little known, but actually very...
He was actually a Russian.
He was born in Poland, and his family escaped to Russia, and he was brought up in Russia, and he considered himself Russian. He invented many myths about himself, so he was a very hard man to track down. But wonderfully eccentric man who, as I say, invented himself in many ways, but was crucial for Jackson because Jackson thought he had been to Paris and had met Picasso and had met Matisse and met Braque, and Graham thought Jackson was a great artist, and he communicated that to Jackson. And so it was really the first time in his whole life that somebody who had the legitimacy of the European modernists said to Jackson, yes, you can be a great artist, yes, you have the talent. I think that was a very important moment for him. And the third one, I would say, undoubtedly, was when he met Lee Krasner, for all the emotional reasons, and that was Lee basically allowed him, sort of freed him from his demons for at least a while, and made it possible for him to do his best work. There's no question she had an incredibly important effect on his life, and I don't think he could have had the career he had without her, without any question.
Having done a biography of this great extent on a man's life, is there anything about your lives that you would like to keep hidden and are trying to do so that nobody will come into your life in the same way you have?
I must We asked ourselves that question, would we want somebody poking around in our lives to the extent that we were poking around in Jackson's? And our feeling was, especially if, like Jackson, we left no children, there was part of us that would almost hope that or wish that we could do something important enough that people would care enough to want to poke around that much. The other effect it had is it made us want to know a lot more about our own families. And here we spent at least a year of those 8 years trying to understand Jackson's parents and his childhood, and we realized that we knew a lot more about Pollock's family than we knew about our own. And we did what I would think that many of the listeners might want to do, and that is we sat down with our respective families and systematically interviewed them as if we were interviewing for a book. And we learned incredible things about our parents and about our grandparents that have never come up in just sort of the course of family conversation.
And I think therefore also about yourselves.
And therefore about ourselves, absolutely. So I think anyone who sees how important the understanding of an early family history can be for understanding someone will want to go back and understand their own family history better. And also can see that even families that don't seem to be terribly, you know, world historically important can be absolutely fascinating. I mean, I think we've certainly been told that the Pollock family and even the Lee Krasner family is almost the stuff of great fiction. I mean, to watch this farm family going from one spot in the Midwest to another and off to the far west, moving every couple of years in this great cathartic exercise of motion, was a fascinating story, even though his parents never did anything that would bring them fame except to have parented Jackson Pollock.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen Nafe and Gregory White-Smith, for coming in and talking with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stephen Nafe and Gregory White-Smith's new biography is called Jackson Pollock, An American Saga. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.